Kreisky Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
I want to start introducing Marco Liotti, which is difficult. You get a little whooshy in your head when you try to try to tell everything that he's done and he is doing. And I want to start with a quote from him, from his website. I specialize in fairly murky and morally dubious subjects, modern Russian history and security affairs, and transnational and organized crime of both past and present. We will, amongst other things, discuss how organized crime and Putin belong to each other and what they have to do with each other. But before that, I want to tell you what he did and who he is. Marco Liotti is a historian, studied in Cambridge, had his PhD at LSE and studied, as he told me, amongst other things, in Russia and worked in Russia for his PhD as well. That's where he picked up his Russian, amongst other things. He was a professor at the New York University, head of the Center of European Security at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, which was one of your favorite stays, I think, because you really like Prague. Okay. Robert Schuman Institute for Advanced Studies, Florence. Director, I think that's an important one, at MIAC Defense Institute in London, right? Which is a consulting firm specialized on Russia. Plus, professor at UCLN's Institute for Slavonic and Eastern European Studies. Plus, fellow at the famous Russi Institute in London. Plus, various other forms and current fellowships and teaching positions, amongst them at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Director at the Organized Russian and European Crime Research Unit. Sakharov Research Center in Kaunas and Las Vegas Mob Museum. What did I miss?
I think that'll do us fine.
Okay. Unless you're exhausted, we can move on from here. Because the next thing I'm going to tell you before we start talking, we have a lot to talk, is that man wrote 25 books, is that right?
At least.
Okay. I am not going to read that list to you. The newest one, which you're working at, is, I could not remember the title, to be honest.
Well, the one that's coming out in June is called Downfall.
I could have remembered that, but there was another one.
And then one that's going to be later in the year is called Forged in War, which is a military history of Russia from the medieval times to the modern.
Okay, so he's working relentlessly. Amongst the books that you might have seen is A Short History of Russia, which I really liked and enjoyed. It was published in 21. There's a little chapter at the end where you try to keep up to reality, which is kind of difficult because, it moves on too quickly. We need to talk about Putin, another great book, Russian Political War, Moving Beyond the Hybrid, which I really like to read, and I have a lot of questions concerning that, and The Vore, Russia's super mafia, which brings us back to the mob and Putin. We'll talk about that later too. And then you've published a lot of books for Osprey, which is a publisher specialized in military history, right? Amongst them, Armies of Russia's War in Ukraine, whatever, and Putin's Wars. So, and most famous in Europe, or in Germany and Austria, is for a very popular podcast, which is called In Moscow's Shadows. And if you haven't heard it, listen to it. There's people who do it every day, and there's about 140 by now?
Yeah, we're 142.
Okay, sorry. I listened to the most recent one today, but I haven't listened to all of them. Almost, though. Okay, so you have an Italian name. Who is Italian in your family?
My father, from whom I therefore acquired the surname Galeotti, which if people don't know actually means galley slave or convicts. So, in other words, studying organized crime was clearly predestined for me.
Okay. And the other question is, you did not really spend like years in Russia like other experts did, but you have a lot of contacts to this day, which you gathered through the years. How do you keep contact now when emails are checked and when people and things are censored, communication censored all the time?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, look, the thing is that I didn't spend 5 years or whatever in Russia, but essentially, apart from the five-year period where the Russians weren't letting me in after a time I'd spent at the Foreign Office, basically, I traveled a lot. I spent, 6 months here, 7 months there, sort of thing. And so the honest answer is that, we were talking about this before, it's a lot easier to keep in touch with people who know you, whom you've known for not just years, but decades. And you knew them before they had a kid, and you're at the kid's christening, or whatever else. And these days, look, I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding that Russia is not North Korea. There is still all sorts of contact back and forth. And some Russians, absolutely, they are scared, frankly, with good reason, of keeping in touch. I mean, in June 2022, I was in the first list of British citizens who were banned from Russia indefinitely, because apparently I of my terrible Russophobic views. As far as I'm concerned, the biggest Russophobe around actually is in the Kremlin. And essentially, I lost then about 30% of my contacts. And I said, I can't blame them. It is a scary time. But for the others, you find all kinds of other ways. There are the more encrypted types of email and messaging apps. But also, look, not every email is being monitored. Not every phone call is listened to. Sometimes you have to be a little bit more sort of discreet or whatever, but people still have conversations.
Can any country besides North Korea still be North Korea in a time when a whole country has been like infiltrated with modern social media? It's impossible, right?
No.
And every Russian with an internet knows how to use VPN.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an interesting thing. I mean, the Russians banned BBC Russian language service, understandably, because they want to sort of prevent alternative sources of information. The audience for BBC Russian last year went up by almost 20%.
Interesting.
Even though it was banned, because precisely Okay. Everyone, the Russians are a very tech-savvy people. Mm. They're very, back in the day when I would be, you'd be on the metro and there would be some granny on her smartphone, busy sort of opening up multiple messaging windows. So yes, Russians still communicate. This is the thing, Russians have had a chance to be connected. They don't want to be disconnected from the rest of the world.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a few general questions and move on to the war against Ukraine and then go back to Putin and more specific questions. But I want to get some things clear as a first start. Putin in 1999 said, Russia has been a great power for centuries. It has legitimate zones of interest. We should not drop our guard or let our views be ignored. These zones of interest, is that a Putin mania? He's been harping on that for a while. Can you define them?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of hard and fast, this country yes, this country no. I mean, he probably has a sense. But I think the whole notion, it really speaks to how Putin, I think, thinks about the world. He is a 19th century geopolitician. You know, Metternich would understand him much better than most modern politicians, I think.
That's why they like him so much here.
he thinks that a great power, exactly as he said there in that quote, Russia is a great power, not because it's got nuclear weapons or whatever else, but because it's Russia. It's Russia's birthright, because Russia has saved civilization. It did so against Napoleon, it did so against the Mongols, it did so against Hitler. We may not believe any of these things, but nonetheless, that's how Putin regards it. And a great power, amongst the other things, it has a sphere of influence, because in Putin's 19th century notion, there are a few countries that matter, a few countries that actually shape the world. For everyone else, the only question is, who owns you? And so this is why, for example, Ukraine is so important to him. He couldn't get his head around the notion that Ukrainians themselves have agency and sovereignty and want to align themselves with Europe and the West. As far as he's concerned, well, if Ukraine isn't ours, it's because someone else has taken it.
But you meant the part that when you said who owns you, it brings me to my next question. Is it our problem, the West's problem, whatever the West, let's not try to define that, but let's just use it. Is it a problem of the West that we probably misunderstand what he understands as a zone of interest? Is it a geopolitical question or is it an ideological question? And is who owns whom also a mindset question?
It is a mindset question. It's one that we don't often understand. But I also think we have to recognize some of our own hypocrisies here. If one looks, take for example some of the debate about Russian operations in Africa. which are sometimes self-interested, sometimes quite ruthless and opportunistic. But it's clear that part of that, certainly from certain countries, and I wouldn't want to mention France, but certain countries, it's almost like, what are the Russians doing in countries that we have own interests?
Earn money?
Well, yeah, but the point is...
Use mines?
Yeah, exactly. But the point is the Russians shouldn't be because they're ours, in effect. I think there is a degree to which in the West we also still have something of a hangover of that notion of spheres of influence. But just with Putin, it is that much more simplistic, frankly, and vivid. And yeah, it is about a mindset. It is about a sense that the world is a very, very nasty place where, you know, essentially you are facing threats at all times. And if you're not winning, you're losing.
Winning and losing is a question of war, which brings me to one question. I laughed about a sentence that you quoted in one of your last podcasts when you said, some guy in the Russian administration said, well, everybody thinks we're going to go after the Balts. We're not going to go after the Balts because in the Balts there's too many Balts. So can you define geopolitically, to go back to that, zones of interest that might be a focus of a future war? And are the Balts part of it, which they fear they are?
I mean, I don't think so, first of all. But to talk first of all about spheres of influence, I mean, I think, again, look, Putin is not trying to recreate the Soviet Union. He's not trying to recreate the Tsarist Empire. In many ways, he doesn't actually want to run a lot of these countries that he thinks are within his sphere of influence. He would have been fine with a Ukraine that just knew its place. Ukrainians can run their own affairs, but they have to realize that when Moscow says no, you don't do it. So, I mean, I think that what he regards as in Russia's sphere of influence are most of the post-Soviet states. So, yes, Central Asia, South Caucasus, Ukraine, Belarus. But I think the Baltic states are different. The Baltic states, after all, were only annexed at the end of after World War II. And I think from Putin's point of view, he's more or less accepted that they're gone. But in terms of war, look, this is a really important point because there's a lot of debate at the moment about, you know, oh, if Putin wins in Ukraine, then he's going to go after NATO next or whatever. Look, I see no signs that he has territorial ambitions on Poland or Finland, countries which were once part of the Tsarist Empire. And also, look, this is a man who spent 20-odd years dumping money into his military, building this shiny military machine that looked so impressive, rolling through Red Square. And then he wasted it in Ukraine. You know, the second most powerful army in the world turned out to be barely the second most powerful army in Ukraine. And, you know, the idea that he could actually build up a force that could challenge NATO, I find very hard to believe.
But, perfect, that brings me to my next question, which is, because maybe he doesn't know. I mean, everybody knows that he is not listening to the people who tell him rational things or things he needs to know. I don't know whether it's true that he doesn't use social media and doesn't have a smartphone, I'm not sure. But it's obvious that he listens to people that tell him what he wants to hear. Yeah. So obviously he ran into this war, he didn't talk to his generals, he gave orders which were ridiculously stupid, he lost that great shining army. Maybe he doesn't know.
This is, for me, one of the most interesting and scary questions. Because look, I think Putin is a rational actor. I mean, a deeply unpleasant rational actor who believes a lot of weird things. But nonetheless, he is not a lunatic. The problem is that even rational actors can do insane things based on what they're told. You're absolutely right there. And I am certain that people sugarcoat what they tell him. I'm sure they spin things in the ways that, because they don't want to arouse his anger. Remember, back in 2015, I was in Moscow and I was meeting with a recently retired Russian spy. Even then, back in 2015, so 9 years ago, he said, look, we have learned you do not bring bad news to the Tsar's table. Even then, they knew that. But, if I can just finish, the one thing is this, however sugar-coated, There's no way that they can pretend that the war in Ukraine has gone swimmingly well. He must be getting at least the battle maps and the raw data. So however much they say, oh, it's because of NATO or whatever else, he cannot think that things have not been, okay, if not catastrophic, but shall we say, not what he expected.
I have difficulties trying to understand how someone can be rational in his own way if he or she, in that case he, is not inclined to get information that goes beyond what you'd put on the Tsar's table. Do you have any idea how he gets information, whom he talks to? Does he read foreign papers? Does he listen to the BBC? I don't know what. Or does he sit in his bunker and wait for someone to bring him his kosher food?
I think, unfortunately, it's mainly the latter. We've had no evidence, really, that he himself tries to basically get out of that information bubble that he's assembled around him. And particularly what we've seen over time, originally his circle of people he listened to was actually quite large and included people who, to a degree, were willing to challenge his assumptions and prejudices. And the classic example that everyone always gives is Kudrin, former finance minister, you know, a relatively liberal sort of person. The point is the Kudrins of this world have long since been pushed out of his circle. It's got smaller and smaller, and you ask who he listens to. Well, it seems to be that there's his mates. And his mates are not, on the whole, in government. They are oligarchs. They are people who have become obscenely rich. You know, look, if Putin is your patron, why bother with the tedious work of actually being in government?
Sorry to interrupt, but I have not seen any indication that he does meet with Abramovich or with, I don't know, he meets with his KGB or FSB guys. They may be his patrons, but are they the people he talks to?
Well, I mean, no, but people like, I mean, we know that he talks to, for example, Sechin, the head of Rosneft. We know that he talks to Kovalchuk, the banker, the Rotenberg brothers. Again, these are sort of not the kind of, because the oligarchs we know are, on the whole, the ones who were once upon a time involved in business in the West. These are not them. These are people who basically have just been given huge chunks of the Russian economy. But the other person he listens to, and this is, again, something that scares me, is clearly the Secretary of the Security Council, Nikolai Patrushev, ex-KGB, hawk. Not a fool, unfortunately, but on the other hand, someone who makes Putin look positively dovish. This is a man who seems to, for example, genuinely believe that a Russian psychic read Madeleine Albright's mind and from that learned about a long-term plan to dismantle the Russian Federation. I mean, the most lunatic conspiracy theories Patrushev regularly trots out when he gives interviews these days. And this is the man who, in effect, has become Putin's national security advisor.
Okay.
It's the man who paints a picture of the outside world for the boss.
Okay. One of the questions that scares me most is actually something that you said before the Ukrainian war, the Russians, don't want to destroy international norms. They want to ignore them. Is that still true?
Yes. I don't think it's that Putin wants to see the whole world devolve into sort of anarchic chaos. I think he just simply feels that as a great power, Russia has the right to ignore those rules when it suits it. Because after all, he feels that this is what America has. He's not totally, totally wrong on that. But nonetheless, again, he takes it to an exaggerated sort of view. So he's fine for there to be all these structures, just as long as every now and then Russia gets to say, sorry, we have our interests and we're going to ignore those rules.
Okay. There's another thing that we're talking about in the West, and we don't really find an answer to that question. Russia has long interpreted the West as committing like hostile acts. You know, the Maidan Revolution, which is incited by the CIA, and the Bolotnoy protests were incited, I don't know, by the West and the U.S. overthrowing regimes, and Russia embattled in the outside world, and all this existential struggle that the Russians are fighting for their righteous place in the world. This is such a I have to put it in psychiatric terms, but this is such a way of mirroring only oneself. Do they see the other side? Do they listen to it? Do they study the other side? Is there still a rationality in looking at the West?
When we say Russians in this context, we're talking about a very small number of Russians. I honestly don't believe that most Russians believe, you know, anything like this sort of huge array of conspiracy theories and paranoid interpretations. I think it's clear that there are a lot of people, even frankly within the senior Russian elite, who know better, who do continue to look at the West. But the point is that when the boss is not interested to hear that, quite the opposite, when the boss will be very unhappy if you express alternative perspectives, I think we have a situation where people just keep that to themselves. And certainly when it comes to sort of Putin and his circle, I think he by now has got a fixed notion. I mean, he's 71, and he's surrounded by people whose almost their job is to be his echo chamber, is to agree with every utterance he gives. In that context, I don't think he's willing to be, shall we say, self-critical.
Okay. One of the answers of the West against this war were sanctions. You say it's not that they don't work. They are like grinding their way into the Russian society. They will work eventually, but yet these sanctions are understood by Moscow as, again, another hostile act. Mm-hmm. And they, at the moment, are quite good in coping with them. Which sanctions, when you look at it, would have been working better, which would have been understood?
I mean, I don't think that sanctions were not going to be that sort of magic weapon. This is one of the problems. Particularly in 2022, a lot of people dramatically talked up how sanctions, they were going to be this magic weapon that was going to bring the Russian economy to its knees and force Putin to change his idea. That was never going to happen. Sanctions in and of themselves very, very rarely work. They are part of a whole array of policies. And so it's not, I mean, I think actually I'd almost turn it around and say I think there's a whole bunch of sanctions we shouldn't have imposed. Well, a lot of the sanctions on individuals. It makes us feel good targeting these oligarchs and so forth. But in practice, what we did is force them to become more dependent on Putin. Secondly, a lot of the controls on Russians themselves. Look, back in the day, there was an Iron Curtain. And the Iron Curtain was established by Moscow to keep its people in. Now we have a new Iron Curtain, which is established by the West to keep the Russians out. And the trouble is, that gives Russians a sense that, in fact, well, maybe the West does hate them. Maybe Putin is right when he says that. For example, the controls on flights. If you're a rich Russian, your private jet can still get you to Dubai, no problem. But that's not the people it actually really affects. So I think we should have been more careful. Instead of just getting enthusiastic about almost, well, what else can we sanction? We got carried away with that. But I think in terms of the core issue, which is actually sanctioning, you know, microchips and similar, you know, elements which go into the
well, that doesn't work because, you know, it goes through Georgia and Azerbaijan and I don't know what.
Again,
Turkey.
This is it. Of course, look, in a globalized economy, there's no way we could ever actually stop. We claimed that we're going to stop these microchips reaching the Russians. Of course, we weren't going to do that. But what we have done is made it more expensive because now they have to have them smuggled in or exactly transferred through a bunch of different shell corporations and through, you know, the United Arab Emirates or Turkey or wherever. It basically costs, on average, between 2 and 3 times as much. Now, that's not exciting, it's not dramatic, but it is a cost. What sanctions do is they impose costs on the Russian war machine. That's a good thing.
But you didn't answer to my question, would there have been smarter sanctions, or is that a question that's not for us because that's for economists to answer?
I mean, look, I don't think there are sanctions that would have had greater effect. What we need to do, what we have to understand, is that the Russians are very smart at working ways around these things. So it's not just a case of saying, well, here's a sanction. Let us admire it and think how clever we are. Because there's a lot of smart, clever people on the other hand thinking, okay, how can we get around this? it's a constantly evolving thing. Real smart sanctions are evolving. So we work out, okay, well, now they're smuggling these microchips this way. How can we stop that?
We're too slow for that, aren't we? Too slow and probably not too divided by now?
Yeah, to a degree, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. I mean, it's like it's like dealing with crime. You know that the criminals will find ways through. Doesn't mean you don't try and stop them.
Okay. Let's talk about one of my favorite topics, hybrid war. It's one of your favorite topics, too. You've written a lot about it, that, too, and you've talked about that.
Except
a lot.
That I hate the term hybrid war.
I know. I was going to come to that. Yes. I know. I have a quote on that, yeah. Hybrid war is like a non-military notion of preparing the battlefield. I'm not sure whether I read that from you, but I quoted it because I liked it. Where does that lead us in the future? If hybrid war is a non-military notion of preparing the battlefield, where does that bring us in the future, and what battlefield?
Well, here's the thing. One of the problems that I have with hybrid war notions is, apart from just simply the term, which is fairly meaningless, is that it implies the Russians have one sense of how it's done.
Yep.
My view is that the Russians have two senses. The military see all these, you know, cyber attacks and subversion and disinformation precisely as ways of preparing the battlefield. Mm. So that by the time you send in your soldiers, you want to try and ensure that the other side is demoralized, uncertain, and everything else. However, I think the political leadership, who are dominant in Russia, I think they have a different notion, and they see hybrid war, political war, call it what you want, as an alternative to the shooting wars.
Okay.
And I think that's what we face.
It's not preliminary action, it's not like a side action?
This is why I don't like this term hybrid war, because it implies that there's always going to be a shooting element. You know, it's well, okay, we've now got disinformation, when do the little green men turn up, as they did in Crimea, for example? That, I think, is a mistake. That's not going to happen, but that doesn't mean to say we're safe. It means that what we face is, as I said, I prefer the term political war. You know, as far as the Russians are concerned, they are in a war with us. They make no bones about it. Putin himself, you know, he won't call what's happening in Ukraine a war. That's a special military operation. But he regards that as just one part of a war that he's fighting with the West. And I think this is it. We have to understand that just because it's not going to turn into a shooting war necessarily, it doesn't mean to say that the Russians are not using every means at their disposal short of that to mess with us.
So that means that modern hybrid warfare and non-linear warfare and asymmetric warfare and geopolitical guerrilla war, which is something that I really like from you too, it's all the same?
I think so. I think we have to acknowledge that, look, in the modern world, you know, we've all become so interconnected. You know, the countries who might become our enemies are probably also our suppliers and our markets. You know, we talk about China, China, the big Chinese threat, while at the same time we're expecting the Chinese to provide us with all the cheap goods that we want in our shops and our smartphones and everything else. You know, we are all connected in a way that we haven't been before. And that is a great thing in terms of it means that, you know, economies become very vibrant and people travel all around the world and so forth. But it also means we have massive vulnerabilities.
Yep.
And that, I think, is just basically the new world in which we live, in which actually we are constantly at threat from these interconnections.
But they are much better in that than we are, aren't they? And are we able to learn? Are we learning quick enough?
We are not necessarily, I don't think we're learning quickly enough to respond to the specific tools that the Russians use. Because in many ways, look, I think Putin regards our greatest vulnerability as being the fact that we're a collection of democracies. Now, personally, I'm all in favor of that. But nonetheless, it does mean that we have all sorts of divisions and disputes within our countries and between our countries, which the Russians can exploit. And it's very hard for us to deal with that while remaining law-based democracies. However, I would just challenge that thing about, well, they're that much better. Again, one of the problems here is that we sometimes don't really want to appreciate that we aren't necessarily quite so altruistic as we might claim.
What do you mean?
You know, foreign aid. Foreign aid is not just about feeding starving people. It's about imposing our own models and how we feel that certain countries should develop. There's always strings attached. We do use all sorts of soft power tools. Yes, we are not in any way doing the sort of disinformation and such like campaigns that the Russians are.
We're just going to say soft power is something else than paying parties in another country or paying deputies of
parliament. Actually, we do have a track record of finding monies for certain politicians and such like that. I mean, I'm not trying to say, oh, well, everyone's the same as bad. I think we do have, shall we say, a different range of tools. But I do worry sometimes that we tend to admire the problem too much. And we think, oh my God, look at what the Russians are doing, look at what the Chinese are doing, look at what the Iranians are doing. How can we possibly match that? We need to be a little bit more self-confident. In fact, we are a lot more resilient often than we give ourselves credit for.
But part of the...
You weren't expecting some optimism there, were you?
No. I'm wondering whether I do agree. Because I'm just thinking of what we all know about the bribes in the European Parliament. We just heard about the voice of... What is it called? The Voice of Europe, whatever what has been discovered in Czech Republic now, paying politicians. I mean, that is brutal. That's not hybrid warfare. It's bribing politics. I mean, whom would you want to bribe? Medvedev? Probably even possible. But
no, I mean, I probably would want to bribe someone who would be more useful and who would need more than just simply a crate of whiskey. The interesting thing is this, though. It's very hard to really say how effective this is. The Russians are very active, and we have a tendency to equate activity with effectiveness. Look at how many fake tweets or social media posts, or look at who was being bribed or whatever. It's very hard often to actually say, and this is what it did. Let me take Brexit as a classic case in point. One close to my heart for all sorts of reasons.
You're a fan of Brexit, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely, quite. The fact that I actually now have to sort of queue up at passport control whenever I come into Europe, it's always a joy. Joking apart, look, I mean, it would be so nice to be able to blame Putin for Brexit. And clearly, from the Russians' point of view, Brexit was great. It was disruptive. It created all kinds of new tensions between Britain and the rest of Europe, and particularly security tensions between the two dominant security powers in Europe, that is Britain and France. From Putin's point of view, it was a gift. And we know that Russian propaganda and so forth did try to support it. However, when one looks at people who are much more versed than me in actually trying to kind of quantify impacts, the impact was points of a percentile. In other words, not enough. Even though the vote was tight, not enough to have actually decided it. Likewise, however much it would be nice in some ways to be able to blame Putin for Donald Trump's, hopefully, I would say presidency rather than first presidency. But again, when it comes down to it, actually, the Russians were active, but they clearly did not elect Trump. So I think one of the issues we have to be aware of is we need to be a lot smarter at thinking, well, okay, but what has this actually done? The Russians have spent money. The Russians have perhaps, corrupted people here, smeared people there. But has it really had an impact? And that's, I think, a lot harder to answer.
Well, maybe I have to... I have to put my doubts in a different question, because you may be right for the West of the West, for Brussels, for Britain, but when you look at Eastern European countries that have been under Russian influence for a long time, Bulgaria, Romania less obviously, Moldova, people that are struggling to move towards the EU, which are a subject of massive, massive Russian infiltration and I'm going to use it, hybrid war and propaganda, and they cannot even work hard enough to keep those Russians and their television stations and the paid oligarchs with their paid parties out. What do you do? I mean, that may be a game changer in the elections in Moldova and in fall. It is a game changer at the moment in Bulgaria. We're losing those countries.
Well, yes and no. I think we are losing them in a way, but again, we're losing them in part because Putin, on the whole, does not win victories. We hand them to him. If we take Bulgaria, for example, we were, I say we, actually, since courtesy of Brexit, you, the European Union
We were a we,
once a we, and who knows. No, essentially, Bulgaria, like many Central European countries, and indeed like aspirant member countries in the Balkans, we ultimately were more interested in stability and business than we were in honesty, transparency, media laws, all of these kind of things. Moldova. I mean, I think there's actually still a lot that can be said about Moldova. I actually think it's a sort of a country that actually has been sort of largely ignored unfairly. But that's the point. Moldova is vulnerable because we basically abandoned it. This is a country that wanted to connect with us, was not immediately saying we want to be members of the European Union next Thursday or whatever. But essentially, they were desperate to begin to form connections. And Brussels, after a certain point, decided that they were just a bit pointless and a bit embarrassing and ignored them. And therefore, the Russians very cheaply could acquire quite important stakes. This is a point, I think, that we sometimes do use the Russians as alibis for our own failures. And yes, the Russians are doing all kinds of bad things. I'm not trying to say otherwise. But I think sometimes we need to think, well, how far have we created this? Because that's how we learn to actually fix these problems. I mean, let me just take Hungary as another example. Viktor Orban often is sort of presented as, you know, Putin's best mate or whatever. Because, yes, Viktor Orban is absolutely the obstacle to any kind of meaningful Europe-wide consensus on Russia. Viktor Orban does not care about Putin. Viktor Orban cares about Viktor Orban. Exactly. Yes. And it's been very handy for him to basically play the Russia card against Brussels.
Makes him very interesting too.
It makes him very interesting and so forth. But the point is that it's because he's been allowed to. When actually Brussels gets tough and essentially threatens the all-important point, which is, in other words, the money that he expects from to be coming, all of a sudden Viktor Orban has a tendency to kind of step into line. Now, this is not me saying that Europe needs to be a stronger superstate. I'm just saying that Europe actually needs to live up. And yes, when I say Europe, I also include the UK. I'm talking geographically, not politically. But actually needs to, frankly, do more of what it says it does.
I agree. Okay. At one point you said that Putin is trying to divide, distract, or dismay us until we agree to a deal. We're talking not only about the Ukraine deal, which is not for us to decide, but maybe agreeing on some kind of peaceful whatever, coexistence, whatever that may look like. Are we close to that deal because he's quite successful in dismaying and disrupting us?
I mean, I don't think so, because there's a big jump between us being so divided and paralyzed and distracted and indeed dismayed that we can't really build a consensus around some clear policy towards Russia. That's a big jump between actually reaching some consensus on a deal with Russia, because the terms that Russia would expect, you know, from Russia's point of view, again, we go back to this early point about, you know, sphere of influence and great power. What Russia would want is not something that we can possibly give. But just to pick up on, you talk about Ukraine and you say it's not for us to make a deal on Ukraine, and you're absolutely right. But remember that in Putin's mind, Ukraine is just simply a tool of the West. Ukraine does what the West tells it to.
Yeah, but when I say it's not for us to decide, I don't mean Putin's way of looking at it,
Iranians. I think it's important to be aware of the fact that Putin expects that somehow we can turn around and tell Zelensky what to do.
Well, after the last half hour, I start to get the impression that half of what of the problems are our fault, which is most probably true, but that they're kind of incompetent, he's rational but then irrational, they don't want to conquer the Baltic states or Poland. So where's the real threat? Is there a real threat?
I mean, if we define the real threat by the idea of Russian tanks rolling through our streets, then no. I think for us in the West, we can sit back comfortably. I think a lot of the talk about Russia will, you know, Putin will not be satisfied, is because exactly there is a lot of Ukraine fatigue in the West, and people are just trying to sort of address that and basically get people committed again.
So it's Western propaganda?
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, spin propaganda, it's politics. But in terms of a threat, look, there's a threat on a whole variety of levels. First of all, look, there's this moral hazard. I mean, there is a moral case to be made for defending Ukraine. What has happened to Ukraine has been, you know, a catastrophic imperialist invasion, which has not just simply been about a military attempt at conquest, it has been associated with vast ranges of war crimes and humanitarian abuses. So one can actually make a case that, I mean, arguably one can make a case that a lot of other conflicts in other parts of the world, people who maybe weren't white, we should have been a little bit more conscious of before. But that doesn't mean to say, therefore, we thought, well, we ignored it in other cases, so we should ignore the Ukrainians. No. So there is a moral case. Secondly, in practical terms, it may not be that Putin would then decide to try and conquer Romania or whatever. But on the other hand, what it may well be is exactly if Putin wins, and certainly wins because we ultimately fold and decide we don't really want to be doing this, we're going to put pressure on Zelensky to make concessions and so forth. It will be a massive lesson for not just Putin, but China and anyone else about how the West is bankrupt. Thirdly, and don't worry, there is a finite, this list is finite. Thirdly, imagine just how disruptive it's going to be for the West. We will dissolve into recriminations and uncertainties, and basically, you know, I think the whole institutions, which have kept the peace for so long.
But that sounds like the support for Ukraine is a kind of self-assertion.
I mean, is it a self-assertion if you see someone, you know, a woman on the other side of the street is being attacked, and you think, well, I don't know her. No, you know, actually, it's because it says something about the order, the society that you want to be in, as well as the values that you think are important. But also, I mean, if you want really practical things, how many more refugees from Ukraine do you want to come?
True.
You know, I mean, how much actual sort of impact will this have on the West directly?
Yeah. I promised the Vori, the mafia. We face a multi-vectoral challenge by the Russians, even though you're trying to put it into proportion, which I think is necessary. I mean, he's mobilizing the Russian state to undermine us with media and with business and with military and with his spetsnaz and with espionage and with the mafia. What does the mafia and what do his friends, the Vori, have to do with it? And maybe you want to explain what that is.
Yeah, I mean, look, Russian organized crime, as you can read in my book, it's a really sort of fascinating phenomenon that has always had a close connection with the state in some form or another. And we see that now under Putin. And in particular, for a couple of reasons. One is that the Russian mafia is truly international. In some ways, it's the most internationalized form of organized crime in the world. And in Europe, the interesting thing is that having initially in the 1990s tried to actually conquer markets and failed, they came back in the 2000s not trying to conquer criminal markets but to serve them. So they approached the local gangs in Austria, in Germany, in France, wherever, and more or less said, look, what do you need? You need drugs? We've got drugs. We can sell you drugs. You need guns. You want women. Whatever, cyber hackers. We can basically provide them all. So they essentially became this sort of one-stop shop for Europe's criminals. And so you won't, on the whole, see them out on the streets. They're not trying to do that. But so let's say, you know, it's a local gangster, drug pusher, who's selling heroin on the street. But when you think, okay, well, where did that heroin come from? And you follow up the supply chain, at some point, probably the Russians have a hand in it. So they're all over the place, but they're fairly subterranean. They're not sort of hanging around, obviously, wearing big gold chains in cafes. And in that respect, they become a very useful asset for Putin now, particularly because so many countries, not all European countries, but so many countries have kicked out so many Russian spies.
Not all European countries,
yeah. Some I think, haven't. But the point is, In those countries where the intelligence networks have become massively attenuated now, well, the Russians are not going to stop doing intelligence operations. They thought, okay, well, who else can we turn to? Who are the other assets? and increasingly they're turning to organised crime for doing everything from gathering intelligence to carrying out hits. We had the recent case of this Russian helicopter pilot who defected to Ukraine and was given a new identity and $500,000 and ended up living in Spain.
He defected to Spain, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, they kind of placed him there, and then he turns up dead. And, I mean, we don't yet know the facts, but for me, it very much looks like he was actually killed by organized Russian organized crime. That the state identified where he was, but because they didn't have any sort of hitmen lying around, but they just simply turned to the Russian organized crime, which is a very sort of powerful force within Spain, and they had actually handled the killing. So I think what we're seeing is this case of, in effect, that the state is turning to organized crime as a subcontractor when it wants to carry out various activities.
And Prigozhin is kind of like a mixture of all that, a bit of a, you know, a bit of a mafia guy, a bit of a, what, I know, Spetsnaz, whatever, and a bit of a Putin servant.
I mean, Prigozhin, I mean, the forthcoming book is about Prigozhin, so.
One of his 50 forthcoming books.
But Prigozhin was an interesting person. It's weird, I mean, actually, when you write about, I mean, this is about Prigozhin's life. It's not just about the Wagner mercenary group, it's about, you know, how he got into it. And it's weird, because you can't immerse yourself in someone's life without it beginning to kind of slightly kind of coming off on you. And I'm not saying that I thought, oh, Prigozhin's actually quite a nice chap. I mean, he clearly is a monster, or was a monster. But nonetheless, one could sometimes see where he came from. And the interesting thing about Prigozhin, we put these labels, oh, you know, mercenary, gangster, whatever. It's a very Western thing. We like to have nice, neat descriptions. Nice, neat, well, you know, you're this thing. You're a spy, you're a gangster, you're a politician. Certainly in Putin's Russia, these definitions are much, much more fluid. Basically, Prigozhin's career was doing whatever the Kremlin wanted doing and making a lot of money out of it. So if it meant running a troll farm today, he was running a troll farm. If it meant setting up a mercenary organization tomorrow, he was going to run a mercenary organization. But when it came down to it, this was all business.
Okay. Let's make a cut here, and let's turn to Ukraine, because they deserve it. It has been kind of a traditional, an amazingly traditional war for a while. It seems to be changing, because the Ukrainians start to build their own weapons, because the drone war has become more relevant. How long can the Ukrainians send in the people that they don't have, that they run away at the moment, before they have to give up?
That's the big uncertainty. I mean, look, the honest answer is, I don't know. But being an academic, I can't give a short answer. So, I mean, I think, but we have to be aware of this basic point that although the Russians have suffered hugely more casualties, proportionate to population, the Ukrainians have suffered greater. And the question is how long they can and are willing to bleed at this rate. Already we're finding that, you know, the days when you had lines of people outside draft offices wanting to serve, they're pretty much gone. Now you've got sort of basically people being snatched off the streets to go and sort of serve in the military. And the whole question of this recent law on conscription became such a hot political issue.
Because that's why it came much too late and too little, probably.
Yeah, exactly. But this is it. I mean, but you know, but people just aren't willing to serve as much. But so, I mean, I think that for me is the big uncertainty. Now, people can do this. I mean, and the Ukrainians have shown this extraordinary commitment to protecting their own sovereignty and indeed building their new nation. People can do this as long as they have hope. And my big concern is, look, the current Ukrainian strategy is clearly to try and hold the line for the moment, because this year the Russians, for various reasons, have the advantage, while building forces so that they can have another counteroffensive next year. And that makes sense, but it's also a big gamble. Because if that counteroffensive fails, I think it's going to be very, very hard for the Ukrainians to motivate themselves to continue to bleed like this.
Yeah, I just want to add something. What made me really angry, I listened to a podcast with Sarah Wagenknecht, infamous Sarah Wagenknecht lately, and she said, well, one proof that the Ukrainians cannot win and don't deserve to win, and why we have to make a very quick peace with Putin is because the Ukrainian men are running away, which is a sign that nobody wants to fight, nobody believes in the country anymore. Put me in a really bad mood, but it is going to be a problem. Let's put it that way. It's going to be a problem that the conscription is going to be a problem, and then the lack of Western weapons has got to be a problem. Do you understand, as a security specialist, why it took 2 years to realize that we should have started weapon production 2 years ago?
Because, take away the rhetoric, on the whole, the West certainly does not seem to genuinely think this is anything like the kind of existential threat that we say. The point is, a defense contractor is not going to reopen a factory or add an additional production line for a year or two. And they turn around, I mean, I remember when, right at the beginning of the war, Britain supplied a lot of NLAWs, which are these very effective shoulder-fired anti-tank missiles, particularly at the point when the Russians were driving at Kyiv. Now, NLAWs are made by Shorts in Belfast, and so the government said to Shorts, okay, we're going to need a lot more NLAWs. Can you produce some more? And they said, well, we've actually stopped production at the moment. We're perfectly happy to reopen, but you're going to have to give us a 5-year contract because, you know, we're a business. And I think this is the problem, that when the war started, no one believed it was going to last that long. Now it's a situation where, frankly, no one wants to, or I say no one, there is an unwillingness to commit the kind of money where you can turn to a defense manufacturer and say, we will guarantee you sales for an enough of a period that this actually will make economic sense for you. I think that's the problem. You point to a government that is currently saying, we really have more money than we know what to do with.
But the bottom line of what you're saying and what's going to let us go home very depressed tonight is that however long it takes and how much it takes, and this is an existential threat for the West, and we have to support Ukraine because otherwise the Russians are not going to stand at the Elbe in 3 months. It's all a lie?
A lie? That's a very stark word. I mean, I think some of these things are... They're political platforms that actually are meant to be the start rather than the end of a political process. You know, when we say, oh, well, we support Ukraine, you know, originally we were saying whatever it takes. In practice, of course, we weren't actually saying we have no interests of our own at stake. If Ukraine had said, look, the only way we can be secure is if our tanks roll through this, you know, Moscow and we topple this regime, we would not have said, oh, well, we did promise after all. Fair enough, we will help you topple Putin. No, I mean, we've made it very clear that there are lines. I think one of the problems is exactly that we fell back on empty rhetoric rather than actually being willing to have the tough conversations. Because the problem is this, there is clearly no true consensus in the West. The threat looks very different from Warsaw to Madrid. The level of commitment that you think that it deserves is very different. Instead of actually sitting down at a relatively early stage and saying, look, this is clearly going to be a serious issue, it's going to be a long-lasting issue, we need to have a position, we hid behind the mantras. Now, that sounds very kind of negative, but sometimes that's the nature of politics, because in some ways people did not want to break the consensus that there was. I mean, we have to acknowledge, actually, while, yes, let's talk about the failures of the West, but let's also acknowledge the astonishing degree of support and coherence that there has been. No one thought that actually we could have sanctions, let alone the level of sustained financial and military support for Ukraine that there has been. So, you know, yes, We could always say it's not as much as there needs to be and so forth, but I think we also have to stop just for a moment and say, actually, we did better than probably if anyone had asked us in December 2021.
I wonder what that means for the belief in democracy, you know, hiding behind mantras and finding that you, in the end, you leave the Ukrainians die in the mud because we cannot bring ourselves to bring up the energy any longer. It makes me very depressed. But in the end, if that is true, will Olaf Scholz end up as the peace chancellor, as the one who's so nicely cautious, because he says no Taurus and we don't want to do too much, we don't want to provoke, we have to, you know, in the background we have to keep our relations up?
No, in my opinion, no, because of the fact that when it comes down to it, it will take robustness to actually bring peace. I think this is one of the problems. A lot of the debate polarizes inaccurately around this sense of that you have the hawks who say, you know, basically more Russians must die, we must give the Ukrainians everything they need and so forth, and the doves who say, no, providing weapons actually prolongs this war and makes everything worse. The irony is actually that the best chance of peace is precisely for Ukraine to look much more formidable than it is. This is one of the reasons why the Ukrainians are building their defense factories. It's because they know they can't entirely trust us.
And they're better than we think.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. As well. So no, I mean, I think the trouble is I don't think that actually making it clear how little you're willing to do. And look, I mean, actually, we should say in financial terms, the Germans have actually been very, very generous. Unfortunately, things tend to get shaped around the rhetoric and specific weapons like the Taurus missile. But basically, I think to start out by saying we want peace, well, Neville Chamberlain tried that. Didn't work out so well.
Is anyone in Russia impressed by the Ukrainian attacks on Russian territory?
I have a feeling that, I mean, we're now seeing a transition, that the drone attacks, which once upon a time were hitting fairly sort of general targets, now are much more focused on energy, you know, oil refineries. Mm-hmm. Now, are any Russians impressed by that? Well, I'm not sure if impressed is quite the right word, though actually it has demonstrated some impressive drone capabilities.
Well, impressed, but, I mean, impressed in the way that you know, being scared mixes with a kind of, well, they know what they're doing, look at them.
Yeah, I think that what it has is, look, the earlier drone attacks, I think, actually were a mistake because they tended to actually make Russians, ordinary Russians, angry. These are actually much, much more effective, both because they are affecting a crucial element of the Russian economy, but also because precisely they are not on the whole targeting civilians. They're making the Ukrainians look much more focused, mm-hmm. and much more sort of sensible, mm-hmm. in terms of how they do this, whereas Putin wants to present the Ukrainians as these unstable Russia haters. So, I mean, I think actually this is a more sensible strategy. Again, you know, no one strategy is going to win the war, but certainly it makes more sense than the earlier drone strategy.
Okay. Let's look at all these wars, at all of Putin's wars. You've written a book about that too, about Chechnya 1 and 2, about Georgia, about Crimea and Donbass, about Syria. Is there a common playbook?
I don't like this American term playbook, because precisely it implies that there is a sort of a standard approach. I mean, there are some certain sort of strategic culture similarities. It's fairly clear that the Russians, or the Russian state rather, I should say not ordinary Russians necessarily, but the Russian state has a much greater tolerance for, let's put it that way, civilian casualties. Whether it's Grozny or whether it's Aleppo or whether it's Mariupol, they are perfectly willing to capture cities by turning them into plains of rubble. It is a very sort of ruthlessly brutal approach. But on the other hand, I mean, it is still mission-focused. It's not just simply to blow things up for the hell of it. It's actually because there is a goal in mind.
But, Chechnya, he destroyed the Russian army destroyed the country to a point where you could not recognize a stone. They are starting to, they did that with Mariupol, they're doing with that with all the Ukrainian cities. What's this, what's the meaning in that senseless destruction of landscapes?
I really don't want to sound as if I'm in any way defending mass brutality, but I would challenge the senseless. There is its own horrendous logic to it, precisely. Take Chechnya. I mean, the reason, for example, that they decided to level Grozny is the first war, they had gone in and actually tried to capture Grozny, and they had got caught in urban warfare that they weren't really geared for, and the Chechens were actually very good at. And so this time they thought, well, no, we're not going to do that. We're just going to basically blow the city apart from the distance with the artillery and the air power that we've got, to which the Chechens have no answer, and then we can rebuild a city afterwards. So in some ways, again, I think this is it. We have to acknowledge that without in any way sanctioning or blessing it, the Russians have an approach that is, in its own ruthless, thuggish way, one that, you know, actually has objectives. And so you go back to this point about playbook. I mean, what one has to acknowledge is, first of all, the Russians will use political warfare very effectively to try and prepare the battlefield. Secondly, that there is that sense that overwhelming force deployed quickly is often the most efficient way of doing things. And thirdly, there is a willingness to basically ignore not just international law, but what we might almost call basic humanity in the pursuit of the objective. And yeah, I mean, this is not because there is something intrinsically inhuman in Russian DNA. It is to a large degree because of the experiences they have been through.
But you know, the question that comes up in every discussion about the Donbas, when you look at pictures at documentaries from how it looks at the moment, the big minefields, the burnt down woods, you know, who's going to live there and when? I mean, the Russians have to rebuild vast landscapes for a lot of money, you know, empty of people. It's going to take years. It's going to take billions. I can see the sense in winning this war or trying to win this war in using terror and destruction. But the costs afterwards are unbelievable.
Two answers. One of them is it wasn't meant to be like this. Remember, as far as Putin was concerned, this was going to be just a neat, quick operation. He would roll in, the Ukrainians would hold up their hands, and essentially he could impose a puppet government, and that it wasn't going to become a big, nasty war. But once it is a big, nasty war, he needs to win it, or at least
whatever it costs,
get something that looks like a victory out of it, yes. But the second point is, and it's an even more cynical one, is, yeah, it's going to have to be rebuilt at a cost that Russia won't be able to afford. But who's going to do the rebuilding? Take a look at where the contracts, for example, for rebuilding Mariupol have gone. Gosh, isn't it strange how many of them have gone to Putin's friends? I mean, actually, the terrible truth of the matter is that war is also an economic activity. And economic activity is good for Putin's mates.
Okay. Let us, for another 10 minutes, talk about the Russian society, and then I'll open the floor for all of you to ask questions, all the ones that I haven't asked and which are on my list. I found this really interesting quote of you, and I wanted to ask you whether you could elaborate on that. This slow eating away of a system leaves Putin sitting on a throne of bayonets, and we all know how uncomfortable that is. Why is he sitting on a throne of bayonets?
I think we often focus too much on the oppressive dimension of Putinism without thinking of, okay, well, how did it, I mean, I say we, I mean, you know, Russian society is not exactly new to you. When Putin came to power, this was, first of all, a leader who a lot of people had a lot of hope in, you know, especially compared after the misery, the abject misery of the 1990s, the violence and the anarchy and so forth. They now had a leader who seemed to be young, competent, sober. You know, all of these things mattered. And Putin was able to capitalize on that. And so he built this system which was kind of democratic. Not entirely, not totally, but there was a democratic dimension to it. And He was able to do that because essentially he provided for Russians equality, or rather, well, he didn't do it himself, but in his early first two presidential terms, Russians began to live better than they had at any point in their lives before. He was lucky, but nonetheless, that luck also transmitted. He had enough money that he could build up his military, enough money to allow his cronies to embezzle on an industrial scale, but also enough money that ordinary Russians could actually get this quality of life that they'd always wanted. And so that was really the basis of Putin's system. It was a social contract. It was, look, you stay out of politics. You know, you vote the way you're meant to vote. And yeah, if you want to have a little bit of civil society, that's fine. But nothing that comes after the Kremlin, as it were. But in return for that, your life will continue to get better. Next year will be better than this year. Your kids are going to live better than you did and such like. And for a lot of Russians, they were perfectly happy to accept that. The thing is that actually that became harder and harder to sustain because it wasn't because of Putinism. It was actually, as I said, because of a series of fortunate kind of concatenations of energy prices and everything else that sort of came together. So Putin was faced with a choice. Either he had to rein in some of his other expenditures, the wars, the cronyism and so forth, or he had to actually basically break his social contract with ordinary Russians. He chose to break his social contract. And therefore, he's increasingly having to depend on authoritarianism.
Well, he's breaking his social contract. That may be true for, you know, installing a dictatorship and making voting more and more, you know, to become a joke. But people earn more. Pensions have risen. Wages have risen. You can still buy everything that you need. Maybe not the quality you used to, but, you know, you can live. As long as you shut up, you can get along quite well.
Yeah, but because we're in the point that actually the sort of the slow grinding deterioration of a system takes time. I mean, if you look at this year, 40% of the entire federal budget went on defense and security.
Yeah.
And to a large extent, where did that come from? It came from spending on infrastructure, on health, on education, on social services, and also on the money that goes to regions to allow them to do things like, you know, rebuild the pipes that bring steam power that heats people's houses in winter,
yep,
which keep exploding. Now, again, that doesn't mean to say that suddenly, overnight, hospitals close. It just means that they haven't got the money for repairs. So whereas they had 4 ambulances this year, next year maybe they'll only have 3 ambulances.
But they haven't had money for repairs for 20 years, so what's new?
Well, no. There was really quite a steady improvement, really, until about 2010. Hmm. Certainly 2008 with the crisis there. But actually, I mean, I think what we have to realise is, yes, in some ways pensions are increasing, and weirdly there are these odd, again, economic side effects. There is a housing boom, a building boom, rather, in Dagestan.
Okay.
Why? A lot of Dagestanis joined the military.
Exactly, yeah.
They died, and therefore their families get these death benefits, and so they think, well, you know, let's do up our flat or build a dacha. So much so that actually, at the moment, there's a shortage of builders in Dagestan. So on one level, you'd think, well, there's a sign of an economic boom. Well, yeah, but it's an economic boom that is bought in blood and is not sustainable in the long term. The bottom line is that Russia is... I think of it this way. Russia is kind of eating through its muscle mass. At the moment, the economy looks as if it's doing fine, but that's because the defense factories are running 24/7. And people's wages look okay because there's competition for labor, because there's not enough workers. But this is not sustainable in the long term.
There was a change in constitution, I think, in 2020, allowing him to stay in power until 36. Can you imagine Vladimir Putin another 50 years, and he's 80-something, about as old as Biden will be if he's re-elected, still being a president of Russia and, you know, ruling over the status quo, the decaying status quo?
I mean, it's a horrific prospect. I almost feel that by that point he'll be a brain in a jar. But on the other hand, or an American politician. I mean, I really don't want to have to think in those terms, but look, it's true that I don't believe that Putin can now stand down. I mean, I think the bottom line is that he is, and I don't think that we should necessarily be shedding bitter tears for him, he's stuck in that job now. I think that before the invasion, I have a suspicion that he was contemplating how he could find some way of, if not standing down, but at least sort of stepping away from the day-to-day governing sort of part. Now he can't. He's in the same position as any mafia don. When everything you have, your security, your money, everything is dependent on your position. And if you step down, you are putting everything in the hands of your successor and having to trust your successor. The thing is, you know, no matter what promises he, and it almost certainly would be he, gives Putin, could Putin trust that? And even if they're meant honestly, after a year or two, the temptation to basically make Putin the scapegoat would be just too great. So I think he's stuck. He can't afford to step down. And therefore, I mean, we can hope that mortality does the job sooner, or a crisis. I mean, I do think that the chances, I mean, we're nowhere near, in my opinion, the point where Putin can be toppled. But each crisis brings us a bit closer to that. So, you know, hopefully we won't have to imagine that.
Okay. Otherwise, we'll meet here with our walking sticks, still watching Putin on television with our 100th State of the Union. Two more questions, and I shut up. One question is, I found so many indications that the rhetoric, not only terror is in the Russian society, the dictatorship when it comes to elections, elections don't work anymore, but there is even Stalinism back. You can find the rhetoric of Stalinism, you can find the ideology of Stalinism, you can find the wording, everything. Do people realize it, and do they like it?
I don't think they like it. I think that precisely it's mobilized by the state very consciously and deliberately because of the deep cultural reservoirs of fear that it generates, but also the deep cultural resonances with that one glorious moment, which is victory in the Great Patriotic War. In other words,
the
Second World War.
So it's the victory in the war that is connected with Stalin. It's not Stalinism.
Well, I think the interesting thing is actually it's a bit of both, that there is a dark and a light side. That in some ways the regime tries to overtly cash in on the idea of, at least under Stalin, we face these extraordinary difficulties, but we won. But then there is also, I think, this dark flip side that is, oh, and by the way, when we're talking about Stalinism, you do remember what else Stalinism involved.
So you better shut up.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a useful way of kind of invoking terror without actually having to apply terror.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Putin was raised as a homo sovieticus, we could say. He's KGB born and raised. What is or will be the new homo Putinis, Putinis or Putinus, my Latin was used to be better.
I mean, I think this is interesting because, I mean, you're absolutely right, and it's not just Putin, but the people closest to him are homo sovieticus. I mean, the people closest to him are pretty much all 68 to 74-year-olds, and they largely come from the same background, ex-KGB, etc. If you look at the next generation, who I think are much less nationalistic in that sense, they are just ruthless, opportunistic kleptocrats. They are really, I think, product of the 1990s, that era when it was that kind of sense of, don't worry about anyone else, just try and make money, whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, I think there is evidence to suggest that Putin is now looking at trying to create a new homo Putinus. I think this is it. I think he's trying to sort of create a new Putinist elite. But the interesting thing is this, we talk about Putin. There is no such thing as Putinism. There is no real coherent ideology. And if you look at, what was the official message of the state, it's changed over the years. You know, Putin in the noughts, it was managerial, it was relatively consensual. I mean, yes, there was the horrible Chechen War, but apart from that, it was more or less saying, look, we're a different type of European country, but we are a European country. Then increasingly, we got the more kind of slightly sort of Eurasianist, we're a unique civilization. Now we have the, we are a beleaguered fortress because the West hates us. So the problem is exactly trying to create, well, which Putin would people be? And I think that very ideological incoherence means that actually Putinism does not have any adherents. People serve this regime because they get advantage from it. And so if there's another generation, maybe they will indeed say, we think Putin is amazing. He is the archetype of humanity to which we all want to aspire. But if then he dies, and I don't know, Mishustin, Prime Minister Mishustin becomes president, I don't think he would, I think just as quickly they would say, Mishustin, he is a god among men. I mean, it's a very, very cynical, pragmatic society, which is ironically a good thing. Because actually, I'm much more afraid of people who are zealots than people who are cynics.
Thank you very much.